few weeks, folks. We've been off on a short hiatus, not a planned one. Last show, I was playing our Journeys as a rerun. I was here in the booth, and had no voice. Laryngitis got me, and there was just absolutely no way I could mic up. So we're back after a month, and had a great vacation the show before that out on the East Coast, and had an amazing time. So it's good to be back in the seat, and back putting on great radio for CHRW listeners here. Today's show is about trans health, and for those of you who don't know what trans is, that is the community that their birth assigned gender does not necessarily reflect how they feel in their heart and their soul about what they are as a person. So I've got some amazing guests here with me in the studio. I've got Zach Templeman, who is a trans guy and great advocate here in the city, and Wes Heaney, who is also a trans guy and an amazing advocate, who does teaching out in public schools and other events. And I had the absolute pleasure of sharing a stage with him Thursday night, talking about this very issue. So thanks for coming out, guys.
Absolutely, good to be here. Thanks.
And later in the show, we have, I caught up earlier on with Shannon Blatt, who is out in Vancouver, who is a trans woman and a lawyer, and we've got that interview later on in the show. So trans health and the barriers to trans health, guys, I mean, it's such a huge issue, and, you know, we've been bantering back and forth about some of the things that we might talk about and some of the stories, starting out, you guys just want to introduce yourselves to the audience and tell them a little bit about your experiences.
All right. Want me to go first? I'm 25, and I basically started socially transitioning about 3 years ago, and I started hormone treatments about a year and a half ago. And my experience with healthcare prior to hormonal transition was pretty much like everyone else's. However, once you start identifying as trans and start that process, it makes, you know, a simple checkup 10 times more complicated. When somebody asks you, are you on any medications? And, you know, you're writing down testosterone and estrogen blockers. They look at you and either assume that, you know, you're taking these things illegally, and they can't figure out why. And once you sort of explain the trans card to them, it's either handled well, or you're looking, you know, you get stared at like you've got worms crawling out of your ears, and people don't really know what to do with it, which is shocking that a medical professional doesn't understand something that is, you know, based on our endocrine system and something that they should have learned in, you know, their first years of medical school.
Exactly. And Zach?
So I'm Zach. I'm a 24-year-old guy. I attend Western here. This will be my last year. Presuming that I pass everything. So I've navigated transition through my university career. So I've been using student health services for accessing what I need for healthcare. For trans-specific care, I've luckily had older members of the community or people who have been in transition before I had telling me how to navigate the system, kind of, and that's definitely made it a lot easier than if I was going at it alone. And I had surgery last December, top surgery, and started hormones about 2.5 years ago, so it's been going pretty good lately, because all that's done with finally, but takes a bit to navigate your way through all of that stuff, and that's trans-specific healthcare, but even just going to the doctor for a physical or for things that are regularly scheduled things for any human to get healthcare takes a bit more when you've got a body that they
don't understand.
Yeah, exactly.
Great, guys. Well, thanks for coming and talking to us about this. I know it's I mean, it's not even always easy coming out on the radio as a trans person, because the marginalization that's faced in society is so huge that it's one of those topics that takes bravery to actually come out and talk about. And thanks to you both for coming out and doing that, and Shannon for coming out. And although she's pretty out herself, she'll tell you later, but she's a tattooed trans woman right on her shoulder, so so nobody misses it. she's quite the fascinating woman, and an amazing advocate for trans rights across the country. So, and I'm, when I'm not on the air as a radio host, I'm actually the executive director of Alphabet Community Center, which is an agency here in London that provides trans health services, referrals for counseling, support services, run a couple of support groups a month here in town for trans individuals. We have the patient advocacy office where we help accompany trans people to medical appointments and other appointments where there may be a power imbalance. So I am host and somewhat expert on the subject as well, and that sometimes makes for a weird dichotomy in radio. Sometimes it's better to be the host and learning along with the listeners, but this is a little different show. So barriers. I mean, when I talk about barriers and healthcare to trans, I typically say there's pretty much three barriers. You've got the transphobia, which is the fear and hatred of trans people and the stigma attached to being trans. You've got the DSM and the mental health attachment to trans bodies that isn't really supposed to be attached, but is nonetheless. And then you've got consent and informed consent versus the hoops that people put you through. Mm-hmm. You guys think that's pretty much it in a nutshell?
I'd say that pretty much encapsulates most of what you deal with in trying to find healthcare.
So let's talk about stigma.
You want to take that one, or you want me to go here?
Go ahead.
In terms of stigma, I'm constantly reminded of I got really sick in the new year and ended up in the hospital for 2 days, and I was at Victoria Hospital here in London. I had influenza horribly. And so I get admitted, and they check me in, and, you know, they're taking a medical history. And Vic Hospital is very much a teaching hospital, so there's a lot of medical students. So, you know, in walks the doctor with 8 medical students, and they're all poking and prodding me, and they've got stethoscopes on me and this and that, and they're asking, well, are you on any medications? And I had told them that I was on, you know, I'm on testosterone and I'm on an estrogen blocker. And all of them just stopped dead in their tracks. And nobody could figure out what I was talking about, why I was taking them. And they sort of said, well, I'm trans. And you could tell some of them had never even heard of it. And then the ones that had sort of, looked at me like I was just this foreign creature. And, you know, if there's ever a place where there shouldn't be stigma, it should be medical professionals. They took an oath and they're supposed to, you know, treat people equally and this and that. But I find that there's so much stigma within the medical community itself. It's still so novel and weird to some people.
Yeah. And when you talk about those people looking at you, that's because they could have been in medical school for 15 years at that point, but there's absolutely nothing in all of the training that doctors get in the province of Ontario that deals with trans.
Yeah, and I think that's a big cause of the stigma, is just the unknown and the medical profession really not knowing how to handle us and what to do with us, and it's just they don't have the training. But there's also, does it take extra training to be able to treat a trans person with a cold as opposed to a cisgender person with a cold? Like,
it doesn't really need. Last time I checked.
Exactly. Like, is that extra training really that necessary? But informing them and having them acknowledge trans existence within medical school would definitely be a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and I should correct that because there is one paragraph in one textbook under psychiatric that's an optional course that you may run into that one paragraph. So, you know, it's there somewhere. But yeah, I have clients that go into the doctor for an earache and get thrown out of the office because they're told, I'm sorry, I don't understand your body. I can't treat your earache. Which I know the listeners are like, what? What are you talking about? An ear is an ear. But that's the stigma, right? And it's masked underneath this, I don't know.
Yeah. It's hard to separate out the real, I don't know how this interacts together with hormones or whatever, but at the same time, if I have the same testosterone levels as a cisgendered male, because that's what I'm being regulated for, then there really isn't a difference in my hormones interacting with a medication or something, like if that was the reasoning or whatever. Like, there may be some unknown as to what our bodies are, but being willing to learn along with us is something that helps with, so it that's how you can separate out the stigma, right?
Exactly.
It's I don't know, but I want to.
Yeah, and I always say that there's three different types of doctors out there. I mean, when I'm doing patient advocacy work and I'm going in with a trans person to an appointment, I'm going to run into one of three types of doctors. I'm going to run into the doctor who is awesome. You know, doesn't bat an eye, may or may not know the answers. But the answer is always, you know, I don't understand that, but I'm going to find out. And I'm going to help you. Right? And that's the great doctor. And then you have the horror doctor that, hey, get out of here. My religion doesn't allow me to talk to you. Or, yeah, I don't know anything about you, get lost. Or, I don't do you people, get lost. You know, that's the horror doctor scenario. And then there's this third doctor that is the one that puts their arm around the trans person and says, you know, I understand what you're going through, and I'm going to help you get better because you don't know what you're talking about. And that's actually the more dangerous doctor, because that's the one that has a smile on their face and is accepting and warm, and they take on a parent role and then perpetuates the absolute worst atrocities against the patient. And those are the ones that really hurt the community.
Mm-hmm. Especially if the trans person going in to see that doctor is already in a place where they're insecure. This is a gatekeeper for them to access the treatment that they want.
As a trans person going into a doctor's office or looking for treatment, I mean, when I started transition, you know, I had met Zach. Zach and I have been friends for a few years, and he started everything about 6 months to a year before I did. So I sort of had a little bit of guidance in terms of this is the clinic you want to get referred to for hormone treatments. But there's all these little nuances and little things that you don't know, and so you assume that you should just expect a certain level of disrespect, and you should just expect it to be awkward and expect to have to fight an uphill battle. And people ask me sometimes, you know, like, why are you so defensive and why are you so aggressive about certain things? And well, I've been, you know, fighting with paperwork and bureaucratic junk and ignorant people since I started this process 3 years ago. So it's awful to walk into a doctor's office and prepare for it to be awful. And like, I have a consult for a completely unrelated bump in my hand in St. Thomas. And the last time I went to this clinic, it was awful. And so you're always bracing for that, which shouldn't be like that for anybody.
Shouldn't be that way at all. And that's the unfortunate reality of most marginalized populations. But this one is one that is in the medical books, in the psychiatric books, And quite frankly, there's been researchers who have done a brutal job of researching trans communities through the years. And that research is out there. I mean, they've done research on whether or not the length of your indexed finger causes you to be trans. I mean, some of the most ridiculous stuff that you'll... I mean, you'd think this stuff was fiction. But it's not. It's in academia. I mean, there's one study that went out to a gay bar and interviewed gay drag queens and then wrote academic paper about how transsexuals are transitioning because they're in love with themselves as a female and they need help accepting their male identities.
And can we clarify this, because this is not so much related to healthcare, but something I encounter a lot when people who are ignorant about trans issues are trying to wrap their heads around it. Drag queens and transsexual people often have nothing in common. You know, like, I mean, I have met many drag queens that simply like to dress up the same way that a lot of other people like to dress up other ways. And I remember talking to somebody who was like, oh, you're trans, like a drag queen, right? And I went, well, do you see me wearing a dress and heels? No.
I may for Halloween, but that's I'm for fun.
Possibly the most unattractive drag queen ever, because I'm just not trying. So it's, you know, like, it. That's something that I constantly run into, that, you know, that association being made that is just so off base.
Because that's, and when we talk about pride and trans bodies, mm-hmm. I mean, that is the image of trans people that pride and the gay and lesbian community have been putting forward to the world in media since mm-hmm. the beginning of time. Whereas both of you guys walking down the street, you're just guys, mm-hmm. right? There's no visibility factor at all.
At this point, no. Early on in transition, you deal with a little more with that. But one thing I've always said too is that as a trans guy, once you start, I hate the term passing, but, you know, once you start passing as your chosen gender, I feel like trans guys have it a lot easier than trans women, because we often blend in a lot better. You know, you start to grow facial hair, you beef up a little, your facial features masculinize. But I know a lot of trans women that, you know, have been on hormones for 5-10 years and still are not socially perceived as female, which, you know, makes it even tougher to go into a doctor's office for strep throat and get treated without the trans issue coming up, or just navigate the world socially when you're not being perceived as your chosen gender.
Yeah, and pretty much, I mean, once you get to the level that you guys are at, and trans women that pass as women and you can't tell they're trans, I mean, once you get to that level, pretty much the only time you deal with the stigma and harassment is with the medical community at that point. I mean, pretty much the rest of your life, you don't really need to tell anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But as soon as you intersect with the medical community, it doesn't matter how much of a guy or a girl you are and you socially pass, like, should that matter? But unfortunately, it does. I mean, at that point, all trans people are the same.
Mm-hmm.
They all have to come out.
Yeah. There's really no choice when you're getting a physical and haven't had bottom surgery or whatever, or don't wish to, then there's going to be something that they're not expecting when we're getting to that point.
Exactly. I got a short clip here. The show, we have this is me section, and this is someone who had an actual great experience at a doctor's office.
Me.
This is what it's like
to be me.
To be me. This is what it's like to be me.
Ah, there we go. It was a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I went to the doctor for sinus problems, and, you know, you have to fill out all the paperwork about what medication you're on and what surgeries have you had and all that kind of stuff, and I was like, I don't know, you know, should I tell him? Should I not tell him? And I got all nervous, and I didn't write it down. And I called my fiance, and I was like, what do I do? So she said that I should just tell the doctor. Doctor comes in and says, hey, how's it going? You know, and starts asking me about. She's like, "So you're not on any medication?" And I say, "Well, actually, I'm trans, and I want testosterone." And she went, "Oh, okay. How long?" And I told her 4 months, almost 5 months, and she's like, "Oh, did you have chest surgery?" And I said, "Yeah, last year." And she's like, "Oh, well, I thought that people usually went on hormones first and then got chest surgery." She was incredible. Like, she listened. She asked questions. She asked, like, she said, she asked me, "When did you know that you were trans?" I mean, and sat and listened to me. This doctor sat in the wait or in the office with me, not only talking about my health problem, my nose, sinus craziness, but also she wanted to know about my trans, my transition and that kind of stuff. And it was just amazing. And, you know, what it kind of made me realize is it's best to be honest and upfront in those situations. Sure, it's scary, and, you know, you can get a bad reaction, that's possible, sure, but it gives people the opportunity to get to know you for who you are. And even if you don't consider your, well, even if that's still nerve-wracking, I guess for me, it gave me the opportunity to trust her. And, you know, because eventually she's going to figure it out. Like, she might give me medication. I got to tell her I'm on testosterone. So, I don't know. It just was the first time I ever had to do it, you know, because it usually, like, before I started testosterone, it was usually people thought I was a guy, and then I spoke, and they were like, "Oh, I'm so sorry." And, you know, so it was just great. So, you know, I just wanted to put that out there. Like, honesty is freaking hard, but it was really great that I just said that to her and that, you know, I might have made a friend. So that was really cool.
And that's what happens when a trans person goes to a medical appointment and has appropriate care. Mm-hmm. And we were talking earlier about that concept about, you know, we shouldn't have these conversations about, hey, I had this great experience at a doctor. They treated me human.
Yeah, it's, you know, to be asked, well, what have your experiences been? Have you received good health care, bad health care? I should just be able to say, I received health care. There should just be a generalized standard that if you are human, you're going to get this much dignity and this much respect. And, you know, it's the same for everybody. Whereas on any given day, you know, going to a walk-in clinic, I either leave happy or I leave miserable for a couple of days, just so angry and, you know, put off by it. But
yeah, and that's what trans people have to deal with is, you know, you're either going to be like this guy and have a fantastic experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was petrified going in and had to call his fiance and say, "Hey, what should I do?" And, you know, how often do you have to, does someone who's not trans have to call home or call their support system and say, "Hey, I'm at a doctor's appointment. You know, do I disclose the medication I'm on?"
Yeah, and that's always, absolutely, that's always something that I'm like, do I do it? Do I not do it? Do I wait and see if I have to? It's always sort of a waiting game.
Well, even in this guy's experience, he said he had an excellent experience, but he was petrified. He had this moment of, I don't know what to do. And this is in his most excellent experience, so that's still problematic.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's where the stigma and healthcare comes in and that kind of thing. And the other major issue that comes, I mean, there's so many issues with trans and healthcare. I mean, I've had 22 surgeries in my life. I had a major traffic accident when I was 17 years old, and I've had 22 operations in 4 different hospitals in 2 different countries. So I'm kind of versed in how the medical systems work here and there. And every single one of those surgeries, I would go in and I would have a consult with the surgeon who would give me informed consent. They would tell me all of the nightmares and horrors of everything that could go wrong. And then I would have to sign on the dotted line and say, I understand all of these things. I understand that I may die. I understand. And then I sign a paper called informed consent. And then I go back into the hospital 2 weeks before my appointment, and they run a whole bunch of tests. And then a couple of weeks later, I have my surgery date, and I go to the hospital and check in, and whether I'm day surgery, I go to the day surgery department. If I'm inpatient, I go to the inpatient check-in, and then they do the surgery, and you recover. And then there's afterwards, you have home care and all of these services available to you to take care of yourself after you. But a trans person who has major surgery, they pay for it up front. They give some surgeon somewhere in the world that they've never met an exorbitantly large sum of money. They never meet them. They check in. They never meet the surgeon. They're on the operating table. They're put out with anesthetic. Still never have met the surgeon. Never have done informed consent. Never have done anything. And then they do the surgery, and as soon as their time that they've paid for has expired, they're kicked out, regardless of their health condition at the time. And then they go home, and there's no aftercare. There's no setup for home care. There's no support. There's no one to call with questions. I mean, that's a two-tier healthcare system where everyone else in society gets healthcare one way. And trans people get healthcare a complete different way.
To counter that, for one second, I had chest surgery July of last year. And I had, with Dr. Hugh McLean in Mississauga, same surgeon that Zach had his surgery with. Yes. And it was wonderful. There was amazing follow-up, amazing administrative staff. I met the surgeon twice beforehand. But I paid $7,000 cash. And so when you're paying that kind of money, there better be incredible, you know, there better be incredible follow-up. Like, I mean, he called me 4 hours after my surgery that night to check on my pain. I had his cell phone number in case I had a problem in the middle of the night. You know, my follow-ups were great and whatnot, but I paid that cash. OHIP didn't cover any of it. There's no financial assistance, and I had to take a month off, leave, unpaid from work because they wouldn't approve me for a medical leave.
And that's the McLean Clinic, and that's an exception to the rule. Because it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And they're a cosmetic surgical center where they're used to doing cosmetic surgeries, and they're used to doing these procedures. And I mean, my only problem with the McLean Clinic is that I was in there and I was talking to him, and I was talking about the fact that I was in negotiations with the Ministry of Health about listing top surgery for guys, and his response to that was, "Oh, then I'll stop doing them."
But he goes by an informed consent, and he does plastic surgeries that way too, right?
Yeah.
So that's his business, that's his decision. But it's
still frustrating.
It's still frustrating to know that an excellent surgeon who can provide this surgery won't do it when he's getting compensated through OHIP.
Because that's how my insurance company dealt with it, too. They went, well, what kind of surgery are you having? And I said, well, I'm transgendered. I have to have top surgery. And they went, oh, we don't cover that. As if I was going in for Botox.
Yeah.
As if I was asking them, you know, I have this bump on my nose. I need a nose job. Can you give me a month paid leave? And, you know, and I fought it for a year, and I just recently got them to write me a check for my month off. And it took about 25 phone calls, about $300 in paperwork, and a year. But I finally got them to pay me out. But it was just assumed that I was just having this, you know, sort
cosmetic
of
procedure.
Cosmetic procedure just to, you know, fix some wrinkles. And, yeah.
Yeah, and that's... And that's unfortunate. But, I mean, the reality is that he gets $7,000 from a trans guy now. He'll get $450 from OHIP.
The last time I was at his clinic and meeting him and seeing what he drives, he's not hurting for money. So, you know, like, it's one of those things that's incredibly frustrating.
And that's my problem with a lot of these great clinics that are out there for trans people and the reality is that they're in it for the money.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And doctors aren't supposed to be in it for the money.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, I mean, it's a job and it pays well, and there's a lot of risks involved, so they should be paid very well for their services. But, I mean, a typical SRS, sex reassignment surgery, you know, there's, what, 15, 20 of them around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, an average annual income is, you know, $100, $200 million. It's absurd.
Yeah.
Amount of money. And they're, and, you know, trans people around the world are, I mean, I say there's three ways that trans people get surgery. They are lucky enough that the government pays for it, which is so rare, or they happen to have health benefits through their employer, or they have financial resources to pay for it themselves, or they do sex work,
mm-hmm.
or they run up their credit cards and default on the payment. I mean, that's the three ways that trans people get surgery, and the first one is rare.
I think I may be a little bit of an exception to that rule, too, because I, my mom actually paid for my chest surgery after she hadn't seen me in about 3 months, and I'd been binding my chest heavily. I was generously endowed prior to surgery, and she showed up and saw me and saw, like, I was becoming almost hunchbacked from how tightly I was binding my chest, and she looked at me and said, "I don't know how I will find the money, but I will find it because you need to have this done, and I can't see you like this." And 2 months later, I had surgery.
And that's an awesome mom. And we'll be back with Wes and Zach after these messages on Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. We are all in this together, brothers and sisters. And welcome back to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9. I'm Michelle Boyce, and I have two great in-studio guests here with me, Zach and Wes, who are trans guys, and we're talking about trans health and the barriers to that. And we're talking about informed consent. And I mean, this is the way the medical system works for all other communities and all other procedures and all other everything that you go through in medical. I mean, I've had 22 surgeries. Every single surgery that I've had, I had to sign a piece of paper that said I understand all of the risks involved. And to get this surgery, I had to sign on the dotted line that I understood these, and then they proceeded with the surgery. And that's the same way for plastic surgery. That is, you know, if some woman wants to have quadruple D mega boobs, that, you know, generally speaking, society will look upon that as probably not in her best interest. But if she hires a surgeon and signs informed consent that she understands that she's going to have back problems, that she understands all of the problem medical issues that she may have from that, and then they'll do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, you said it best the other night when you were talking about genitals and surgery.
I'm trying to remember.
And
what
and
exactly
how it goes crazy when all of a sudden genitals are involved in surgery. And
well, yeah, it's, I mean, that seems to be everybody's, I mean, in terms of everything, because we tie so much up into what's between your legs. And, you know, it's such a small part of the picture, because if you've got somebody who loses a testicle to prostate cancer, are they no longer a man? If you have a woman with breast cancer that loses her breasts, are they no longer a woman? And so, you know, it's constantly an issue of, and people's questions always go to that. You know, I remember meeting somebody, and within the first 5 minutes, they asked me, "Well, what surgeries have you had? Have you had surgery down there? Have you had that fixed?" I'm going, well, that's like me walking up to you and going, "Oh, hi, nice to meet you. What's your bra size? Like, why is this relevant?" And, you know, I've had medical professionals ask me, too, "So is your sex change complete?"
Yeah.
And I've looked at them and gone, "Well, what do you mean by complete? I mean, complete for you and complete for me could be two totally different things. Some trans people never even want surgery.
At all.
And some can't wait to have it, and some want, you know, one and not the other. And some are still deciding.
Exactly. And all of that is okay. And that's
mm-hmm.
and that's in that, you know, that great brilliance between male and female that, I mean, everybody thinks that sex is a binary. But in reality, there's not a single listener out there that can tell me that they're dramatically on a pole, stereotypically male and stereotypically female, and they never think about anything other than that stereotype. So, I mean, it's crazy. But I want to get Shannon on here, and she's got a clip here that's fairly long, and she talks about a lot of these issues, and this is Shannon Blatt.
Hi, my name is Shannon Blatt. I'm a transsexual, trans woman, transitioned about 10 years ago, started my process. I'm a labor lawyer for a Canadian trade union, and also dabble in trans activism and organizing and education work.
And you're on the West Coast.
I am presently, living in Vancouver after grew up in Edmonton, Alberta area, and left there when I was 20 for Ontario, spent 20 years in Ottawa, and then 2 years ago I moved to Vancouver.
So you transitioned 10 years ago.
Well, started the process about 10 years ago, yeah.
And I one of the speakers last night said at the event I was at, define beginning and end of any transition in life, because life is fluid.
I think that's a good point. You know, I mean, 10 years ago I began learning more and, connecting with health professionals that could assist in the process, first with getting my depression under control and then hormone therapy and some, feminizing surgeries, and gradually over time moved further and further through that process. You know, I'm now living female since 2003, and I've had numerous surgeries and, kind of occupy female social space, I guess, but I'm very out as a trans person and militantly out, I would say. I'm very proud to be a trans person and to be an out trans person. So I don't know where the transition ends. I continue to evolve. There's no doubt about it. I'm currently kind of like doing a butch thing these days, which is feeling kind of awesome and a bit brave sometimes, because sometimes it leads to people gendering you the wrong way, which is something I tried to avoid very hard for years, and now I'm getting comfortable with that. And
yeah, well, I tend to find that trans people tend to run on a pendulum, and trans women, for example, tend to start their transition and they swing way over to this super high femme, high maintenance, stereotypical view of womanhood, and then the pendulum tends to swing back the other side, and they see just how far they could push butch, and then it swings back and forth, and then eventually somewhere it rests where, people are comfortable with it.
Yeah, I think mine is actually just in the last week or so, I'm feeling this kind of tug back towards, I was like, I really want to put on some lipstick today, or, some blush or some eyeshadow or something, or maybe I'll wear a skirt. But I haven't yet. I'm still in my boy 501s and my boots and my flannel shirts and stuff like that, enjoying that. But I can feel the pendulum starting to maybe move back. I don't know. It's a constant source of...
It's nothing different than any puberty girl goes through, right? They do the same pendulum stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right. We all go through that awkward sort of 13, 14-year-old girl phase at the beginning, right?
Exactly.
Ooh, that outfit is inappropriate. Boy, are you wearing too much makeup, or whatever.
Yeah, well, it tends to be more acceptable for when you're 14 than when you're 40.
Yeah, definitely. People look at you a little, like, roll eyes.
So when you transitioned, what kind of barriers stood in your way?
Well, I think the worst barriers for me initially were the ones I had erected within myself, through shame and fear and catastrophic visions of what my future would be. I believed that I would get disbarred as a lawyer just for being trans. I honestly believed that for a while. So there were all those internal psychological barriers that kept me from maybe living as healthily as I ought to and as self-lovingly as I ought to. And then actually accessing services. It was not too bad in Ottawa. You could find the services, but there wasn't exactly an abundance of them. There's one doctor handling hormones, and there's one psychiatrist handling letters for those who want surgery, that kind of thing. But I honestly had a relatively good experience in terms of accessing those services. A couple years later, had I started my process, I might have faced greater barriers. For example, the doctor who was handling the hormones had to stop taking new patients for a time. And that led to a crisis in Ottawa of a lack of access to hormone therapy because GPs were not comfortable. People didn't necessarily have the advocacy skills to negotiate with their GPs and train their GPs to get them comfortable with hormone therapy. So I was fortunate, I think, in terms of the point in time that I started was just right, where there were the psychiatrist was still taking patients, as was the gynecologist. Barriers were not huge for me. I had, I think, an unusually good experience compared to a lot of the stories I hear from colleagues and friends in other parts of Canada or even other parts of Ontario or even in Ottawa at different...
So when we talk about accessing those care, would it be fair to say that basically you had just had informed consent, or was there an approval process that was put in place for you?
I would say that in my case, access to hormones was pretty much an informed consent situation. I got a referral by my GP to Dr. Barwin, the gynecologist, and my appointment arrived, and I played by, you know, the rules that I was learning online and from reading, which is show up looking very feminine for your hormone appointment, you know, so I kind of over-the-top femmed and everything. He did not erect any, he confirmed that I was seeing a mental health professional and had their support, but he didn't ask for any letters from that person or even for contact information to consult with them. I had also, the very first thing I did was, before hormones, I had gone to Montreal and had a tracheal shave surgery because I had a fairly pronounced Adam's apple, and I really wanted rid of that. And I did that. That required no letters. It was a purely cosmetic procedure. So there was no gatekeeping. There was just, you know, give us your visa number. Having done that surgery already, when I went for my hormone appointment, I think assisted the doctor in concluding that I was serious and had... He basically asked a few questions to make sure that you yourself were informed and understood the significance of the measures that you were asking for from the doctor, in other words, a hormone prescription. And I think he just sort of, he'd been treating trans people for a couple decades at least at that point, more like 30 years. So I think he had a good sense of each individual and just kind of judged them. But I would also have to emphasize that I came in as an older, educated lawyer with advocacy skills and negotiation skills and a certain ability to persuade. And so I kind of just had my plan in place. I mean, I didn't lie. I think I came across as knowledgeable and reliable and solid and not flighty. And so I caused him to feel comfortable prescribing to me. And I walked out of there with my hormone prescriptions and arrangements to, you know, store my DNA material and stuff like that. So no major gatekeeping there. In terms of access to surgery, you know, there were the standard barriers that are erected through the standards of care. At that point in time, it was still the Harry Benjamin International Gender Dysphoria Association, which has now become WPATH, the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, that published the standards of care for gender identity disorders. Those are a fairly onerous set of gates to be navigated and hoops to jump through in terms of getting access to hormones and surgeries. And so to get letters for surgery, I complied with all of those, you know, the standards of care processes of the real life test, lived in the target gender, et cetera, for a year before getting surgery letters. So in that sense, the formal, normal, standard barriers that are sort of exist institutionally were in place, and I had to face those, but I was able to successfully navigate them. Again, in part, I think, because of my age and my ability to be articulate and have negotiation skills, et cetera. I know for a fact that there were people younger than me that had different experiences than I using the same healthcare providers that faced barriers. Sometimes these seem to be very much age-based. Proceeding beyond that, there are financial barriers. Ontario was not funding sex reassignment surgery at the time that I was transitioning. It was still during that, you know, the roughly 10-year period of delisting from the Ontario Health Insurance Plan. I went about my own means of trying to secure funding, and I lobbied my employer to introduce insurance coverage. And I was fortunately successful in doing that because my employer is self-insured and a very progressive labor union that wanted to be showing leadership on these issues. So I was very, very fortunate in that sense and was able to get insurance coverage that covered significant costs of my transition. It covered breast surgery. It covered $5,000 in facial hair removal. It covered my tracheal shave. It covered bottom surgery, genital surgery, and of course a Cadillac drug plan covered, you know, expensive hormone medication. So there were barriers, but I feel guilty sometimes, almost like a survivor guilt, at having had such a relatively easy passage through those systems. I faced very little nonsense.
Now, as you were going through those imposed hoops and hurdles, do you think there was any value in them?
I don't think that they held value. Value for me?
Yes.
Not so much. I think there's great value for the medical practitioners in the sense that it gives them a structure that helps them document that they've taken appropriate internationally agreed upon step to slowly move somebody along through a process to hormone access and then, you know, major alteration of the body through surgeries. I think it has great value for those individuals and their comfort levels and their liability concerns and things like that. For me, I was not in a great rush. I was already committed to moving fairly slowly and carefully through the process and checking myself along the way because I had a lot of fear and shame built up within myself, and it took a long time to shed those things. On one level, I would say, yes, there was a certain value in that it kept me moving slowly, deliberately, methodically through these prescribed steps. But as a general rule, looking back on it now, I'm not sure. I don't think that can justify the continued existence of that gatekeeping, highly controlling regime that's in place. I think that had I simply been entitled to proceed on the basis of informed consent and had knowledgeable healthcare providers providing me with solid information so that I could make decisions for myself, I think I would have made the same decisions and proceeded probably at a very fairly similar pace. There are other people that are feeling a greater sense of urgency that I think the gatekeeping process can be quite damaging to. Because I think by and large, there's been this sort of built-in assumption within the psychiatric community and even the public at large that, you know, trans people are kind of crazy. We need to be protected from ourselves. Oh boy, we're going to go hurt ourselves. And there's this insane, people are allowed to go without psychiatric letters. They can go alter any part of their body they want to just about, except their genitals. There's this inexplicable rigidity around, oh my God, you're going to alter your genitals or eliminate your ability to reproduce potentially by having, you know, a oophorectomy or hysterectomy or an orchiectomy, and that somehow this triggers this heightened, panicked almost concern on the part of the healthcare profession that, oh, we've got to, you know, go have your breast surgery, go have your nose job, go have injection fillers for your hips or your lips or whatever, but Lord help you if you decide that you want a vagina instead of a penis. Then, you know, it's like the man trap comes down and you're trapped into this rigid system where you suddenly have to follow all of these hoops. It's always struck me as quite bizarre that it's this one part of the body that attracts so much regulation. Circling back, you know, was there value for me? Not greatly. I don't think there was any need for those hoops. The long and short of it, I believe that an informed consent system would be preferable and provides a much greater measure of dignity to the person seeking transition assistance, a medicalized transition assistance.
So moving on to hot topics in the trans community, how about the APA's revision to the DSM?
I know that is a super hot topic, and the DSM-5 is due to be released soon. Yeah, and that's coming, and I know there's been a great deal of controversy in particular about the characters, the individuals who are responsible for revising the gender identity portions of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the psychiatric, you know, desk reference and Bible of diagnosis for mental disorder. There are individuals involved in that do not have the respect or trust of trans people. Without question, these are individuals who are seen as oppressive and purveyors of hurtful theories, hurtful measures towards trans children, for example, and particularly towards trans women, and particularly towards queer trans women. So there's concern about people like a Dr. Zucker and some of that crowd, you know, Dr. Dickey, Dr. Blanchard, Dr. Bailey. Personally, my view for a long time has been sort of this mantra of, you know, medical condition, not mental disorder, to characterize transness. I would favor a complete removal from the DSM. We just shouldn't be there. Homosexual disorder or homosexuality was considered a psychiatric illness for decades until 1972 or 73, when they all just realized, like, my goodness, these people aren't actually suffering from this. What they're suffering from is perhaps being psychopathologized and being marginalized, but there's nothing inherently pathological about being homosexual. Therefore, here, we'll just remove them from the book. And just like that, it wasn't a mental disorder anymore. I see no reason why we can't follow the same path concerning trans people. My understanding is that's already occurring in parts of Europe where the DSM is not the dominant document used for diagnosis and treatment, and instead it's the ICD, the International Classification of Diseases. And in France, for example, they've decided that they're just not going to consider transsexualism a psychiatric condition anymore. They're going to treat it as a medical condition for which there are appropriate measures, including hormones and therapy. So I see no reason why we shouldn't follow the same process here. I think that benefits trans people's social position and their individual and collective dignity by removing the stigma of mental disorder from us. The caveat that I would express that I think a lot of us are alive to and concerned about is that in a country like Canada, where we have public medical insurance plan and in for trans-related health care and specifically for sex reassignment surgery, if you eliminate all medical, there would no longer be something to insure. And so trans people would be left without access to funded public insurance for their surgery. And given our economic marginalization as a community, that would present a big barrier for a lot of people to not have access to the publicly funded surgery. I believe there's a balance in between delisting from the DSM and eliminating diagnosis of a mental disorder and the stigma associated with psychopathologization. We don't have to just strike it out of that book and then never have any medical access again. It could be dealt with the way it is in France, as I understand things are now being done in France, where it's considered a medical condition and you still have access to appropriate health measures through health practitioners.
Anything else about being trans that you'd like to talk about?
Being trans is awesome. Awesome. That's what I want to say. And that we need to love ourselves more as trans people and celebrate who we are in all of our beauty and sexiness and ferocity and brilliance. I think trans people are amazing. I have so many amazing trans friends that inspire me, including you very much, who have inspired me over time and whose courage and tenacity and ferocity and commitment to justice and dignity and human rights, not just for our community, but for all marginalized communities, truly inspire me. And the one thing that hurts me most about being trans is when I see people who are not loving their transness and are not celebrating it. I'm a big believer in being fiercely, proudly, aggressively out. I know it's a complex issue, but as a general rule, I'm opposed to living stealth. I think it's a happier life to acknowledge the complexity and completeness of the entirety of one's life experience and not disconnect or erase one's own past, because I think we are the products of the entirety of our lives experiences. I think we can do those things without challenging, negating, or diluting our identities. I think sometimes people do these things out of a desire to ensure that nobody understands them as other than they want to be understood. And so we often decline to share our histories with people, even people we're very close with. And, you know, at this point in my politics and my philosophy of the thing, I feel sad when that happens. I respect each individual's choice, but I have personally found myself to be happier, more empowered, when I'm very out and proud and never willing to pretend that being trans is something lesser than any other way of being. And I've got a tattoo on my shoulder that it's like an anchor, but it's stylized out of words, and it says trans girl. I've like marked myself as trans. I will never hide. So I don't know. There's my long rambly answer to what else would I want to say about trans people, is that we're awesome.
We are
amazing. We've always been part of the human narrative. We're often erased from histories and social histories of, well, whether they're queer histories or they're social histories of feminism or anti-racist work or whatever. There have always been trans people involved in this work. We've always been part of society and the fabric of human history, cross-culturally around the world and throughout history. And I think it's time that the world start acknowledging us and writing us back into its history. And I'm really kind of adamant about that at this point. I think until we deserve to have good things said about us. We are awesome. I'm not saying we're more awesome than other ways of being or other people, but we're just as awesome, and we don't always act like we are. And there's a host and a deluge of messaging in mainstream media and in queer media that tells us otherwise, that tries to other us, tries to exclude us, tries to erase us, tries to pathologize us, tries to defabulous us. You know what I mean? And yet we are fabulous and awesome and have so much to be proud of. And I think, you know, a recent experience just this year in Vancouver, being part of a organizing collective to have a trans pride march and a trans protest march this year. And we had about 100 participants, and I would say at least half of them were probably under 25 years old, and they were so stoked, so pumped about the positivity and about being able to transmit a positive message about themselves with great pride. It's left me just in tears several times when I think about it, and I continue to see the enthusiasm from some of these individuals posting on Facebook and whatnot, videos of the march, and I really believe this is the way to go, is we have to really claim pride and celebration in ourselves, in our community, in our strength, our history, that I'm convinced, therefore, that I'm on the right track, at least for me, to living as a really, really happy, out, proud trans woman. We know there are people that struggle with shame still, even many years after transition, right? I have friends that I see struggling with internalized transphobia, internalized transmisogyny, internalized shame, and it breaks my heart because they're such amazing people.
Yeah, it's a years and years of healing process, and I mean, the damage that society does to trans people takes years to heal, and...
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't happen overnight. But, you know, as long as you've got the support and you've got, you know, the people behind you and the barriers are bearable and all of that, and, you know, it does get better.
Yeah, it really does get better. Certainly as for me, I'm happier than I've ever been. Gender transition was the hardest and best and smartest thing I ever did in my life. I don't think I'd be alive today if I had not done so. And yet now I'm happy to be alive. Here's to living our personal truths and believing in those.
Absolutely.
You know, what do you think about what Shannon said about this informed consent piece? And we have the WPATH standards that, you know, which is the World Psychiatric, I'm losing it at the moment, trans health rules, we'll call it that. And in that, you know, they set up these rigid rules that I know maybe three trans people in the 15 years that I've been supporting the community that actually have transitioned, and the transition looks like that.
Yeah.
You know, and I've transitioned probably 3,000 people in the city of London over the last 15 years, possibly up at as high as 5,000. I don't keep exact numbers in track, but, you know, out of 3,000 to 5,000 people in the city that I have helped transition, 6 fit into that cookie cutter for transition.
Yeah. And I think she made an absolutely great point when she said that the value is added for the medical community, but not necessarily for the trans person themselves. And if this is serving people who are trans, then it should add value to their transition and their lives. I do think it's important, if we're utilizing the medical community, to have some sort of way for them to know how to navigate it. But I think that that's a little rigid and a little timely, and setting up those hoops for people who have that sense of urgency is probably part of the contributor to the high suicide rates and the depression that we see in the community.
Exactly. And for those that don't know the suicide rate, I mean, 77% of the trans community has seriously considered suicide in their lifetime. And I mean, comparing statistically wise, I mean, the next highest marginalized community that faces suicide stats is, and I think it's the bi community that has 35%. So, just gives you an idea of how phenomenally high the suicide rates are within the trans community.
Well, I think it speaks volumes when you look at the fact that for a lot of the treatment that I received in medical referrals, in order to get those referrals, I had to claim to have gender identity disorder. I had to claim to have a psychiatric illness. And when you are constantly having to reaffirm yourself as being crazy, you start to feel crazy, because you're basically having to say, well, I need medical treatment for a psychiatric disorder. How does this? Shouldn't you be giving me antidepressants? Shouldn't I be having anti-anxiety meds if I have a psychiatric disorder? You should be giving me psychiatric meds. But no, I want an endocrinologist to treat me hormonally. Why do I need to claim to have a psychiatric illness just to access care for my body?
And what other psychiatric condition has a medical solution?
Nothing. Yeah.
Well, and even those that use medications as a medical solution, they're still primarily accompanied by a therapy or something that is the main way to drive or to solve the issue or to help with the mental health problem, right?
Exactly. And I mean, that's where the disconnect is between trans health and everything else. I mean, trans people need to go to their doctor. Their doctor needs to involve the specialists that they need for their transition. And the doctor, their family doctor, needs to keep them as a patient. And then they move on. And I mean, when we talk about the WPATH standards, I mean, it doesn't fit because I have people who take 20, 30 years to transition. And I have people that transition in 6 months. And, you know, those standards don't fit for either of those extremes. Either way. And that's the trans community, because every single trans person has a different life. They have different family. They have different workplaces. They have different factors in their life that factor into how fast or how slow that they need to transition to be healthy individuals. And informed consent, in my opinion, is the only method that actually takes in account all of these variations in a hugely diverse community.
Absolutely. Like, informed consent gives the medical community that added value as well. It's just in the form of, here's your education on what you're doing. You be okay with that and give me permission to do it.
Exactly. So, guys, we are out of time here at Between the Margins. I'm Michelle Boyce. I'm here with Zach Templeman and Wes Hanley, and Sharon Blatt was in the interview earlier. If you want to listen to podcasts of Between the Margins, they're all on www.betweenthemargins.ca, and there's contact information there as well. If you have any other questions, feel free to talk to me, and we can answer those as well. This is Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after on CHRW 94.9 FM. Have a healthy day.